UA bookstore. And I want to remind you that thanks to a small grant from the Arizona Humanities Council, we're also running a series of talks by our visiting writers this spring. So tomorrow at 11 in Student Union Room 285, Greg Pape will be giving a talk that we originally called Poetry and a Palpable Sense of Time, and in true poetic fashion it may wander wonderfully from that title, but please come to that as well. We're starting this semester series by inviting one of our graduates of the MFA program, and we're trying to make a habit of bringing one person back, at least one each year. Greg Pape grew up, at least in part, in Tucson and received his MFA here. He also studied with Phil Levine at Cal State in Fresno. He's the author of Border Crossings, Black Branches, Storm Pattern, all published by Pittsburgh, and Sunflower Facing the Sun, which won the Edward Ford Piper Award from the University of Iowa Press. He's won many awards and fellowships, among them fellowships at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, NEAs and Pushcart Prizes. He's taught all over the country, in public schools and Indian reservations in Arizona, and I think he told me 11 colleges and universities before he really found a home at the University of Montana, where he now teaches in the creative writing program. I've admired his work for a long time. His poems have a strong narrative line, a compelling sense of place, and the effect of place on one's inner landscape. The sense of place is very far-ranging in his poems. They make readings of the lands and ruins of the Southwest, of the birthing room where his son is born, of Tucson's own no-tell motel, of a peach orchard where a young man shakes free the harvest with a hydraulic arm while imagining his lover parting her lips for the deep kiss that leads to heaven. And in each place he seems to find, in his words, things in life that happen only once and make us who we are. Please welcome Greg Pape.
It's really nice to be back in Tucson, especially because I live in Montana, and in January, everybody in Montana would like to be in Tucson. This morning, Allison and I took a walk. I was really anxious to get out into the countryside here. We went down to Madera Canyon, and we walked up and around and looking for birds and things like that. And I thought I would read for Allison a poem about a bird. You know, this is a Florida bird called an ani. Any of you ever seen an ani? Yeah, it's a big, ugly bird. October, November, December. I've forgotten the month, but I remember the moment I first saw the ani, perched on the limb of a young tree, planted in the divider strip of a parking lot in South Florida, North Miami, Bay Vista, where they used to dump toxic waste in the mangroves, then paved it over and built a university. I worked there 2 years. The limb was so slight and the ani so heavy, it bobbed up and down in the breeze. Clouds loomed above the sea. Tar black and shining in the sun, its big grotesque beak in profile. It looked straight at me with one eye glinting like a black pearl. I am the Lord God of this exact place, it said. Who are you? Bird watching turned around. I'll read a few. I've moved around so much that I tend to associate my poems with the places I wrote them and the places they live. This one is an Arizona poem. It's called The Morning Horse Canyon Dechet. Standing on the slick rock, looking down into the still shaded canyon, the man and the woman could see a mud-roofed hogan with the top half of the east-facing door open, waiting for sunlight. A horse walked over to the door and put its head in as if to say good morning, or it's about time, or here I am, your horse, just like yesterday. Then before the sun touched the horse's back, before the sheep came bounding out of their pens, adding their baas and bells to the quiet of the canyon, they eased down the trail in the morning air toward White House ruin. Ravens rode the thermals, and red lizards pulsed in red dust. The trail ran out at the river, so they took off their shoes and hung them on their shoulders and walked on in the cold, shallow water. Now, weeks later, as she sleeps beside him, he thinks of the horse. He thinks the mornings come to him like that, that into the darkness of sleep there comes a long, dark face with large, questioning eyes, whose light he feels in his own before he opens them. Before he turns to her or she turns to him, the day is already moving in each of them, like sun into the canyon, to light the ruins and the river and the horse that wants. This poem is set in Chaco Canyon. Some of you may have been to Chaco Canyon. The wonderful, it's probably the most extensive ruins in the United States. And they're fabulous, beautifully constructed. And even seeing them 1,000 years after they were abandoned, they're quite impressive. People, stonemasons today, people who work with stone, look at this stuff and can't figure out how it was done so well. Wijiji is the name of one of the houses, one of the great houses in Chaco Canyon. And we're in the Southwest. I probably don't have to explain all the stuff in here, so I won't. Someone found the ochre clay or ground soft stone colored by iron oxide and mixed it in a bowl. Someone cut the hollow reed from the rushes along the arroyo or fashioned the long bone of an eagle's wing. Someone pressed a hand on the canyon wall and blew the liquid ochre onto hand and stone. Someone 1,000 years ago made this image, a yellow glow around an absent hand. There must have been joy in the moment of making, and joy touched with sadness in the moments afterward, just as there is now in the way the glow holds to the shape of the hand that's gone. On my way to this place, I thought of you, the one I ask so much of. Storm clouds rose over Chakra Mesa. Fajada Butte stood alone with its secret knowledge of the sun. I walked up the path in the changing light of the canyon toward Wijiji, least of the great houses of Chaco, place abandoned for 1,000 years, word uttered by the body of a hummingbird. No one knows what it means. Wind came up through the sage and brought the smell of rain. Somewhere in the rocks, Cocopelli, with his burden of seeds and his flute, bent over and blew his hopeful music down on the husks. The seed of that music opened and rose, waved and clattered like green corn. Virga blew in tattered curtains above the mesa. A hummingbird hovered at a red flower. At the base of the canyon wall, when the wind stopped, I knelt before water symbols, migration spirals, the wolf pulling down the deer, the mother giving birth, and the small absent hand lit with a yellow glow. I put my hand to the image and saw it disappear. More than one or the other, more than all the regrets, more than the hand that touches, it is the touching that lasts. I just got back from a really fine fall semester down in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I had been down there 10 years ago, and I had some good friends still down there. And it was nice to get away from all the responsibilities of home in Montana for a while. And I had written a poem 10 years, or I started a poem 10 years ago, that it sometimes takes me about 5 years to finish a poem. And this is one, it's dated, so I know that it took a long time. It was just came out in the book last year. And the title of the poem is Trains, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Spring 1983. That's when I started it. And one of the things about living in Tuscaloosa, it's kind of like Tucson if you live on this side of town. You hear the trains coming through town at night and at different times during the day and early in the morning, and you listen to them a lot, and you get to where you can tell time by listening to these trains. But when I lived in Tuscaloosa the first time, I lived in a neighborhood right next to a spur of the railroad track that went down to the Black Warrior River, and they loaded coal barges there. The trains would bring the coal in, come down this little spur, and load them onto the boats at night. So I was perfectly aware of when a train came by and just shake the house. And I had to deal with it, and I tried to make it into a positive thing. Here's the poem. I know when a train is coming. I can feel it in my feet. My azaleas tremble. My windows creak. The people who live along the tracks have learned to ignore trains in order to sleep, learned long ago to include them like bad weather in the ragged sequences of their dreams. Dreams are nothing but the impure fuel the world burns, the black coal that fills the barges and trains, that moves on the rivers and tracks in the heavy commerce of night. It's night now, and rain falls soft as soot from the Goodrich stacks. Men in black gloves breathe the oxides and sweat at the presses and molds. I listen for trains, imagining the cigarette burns in each petal of dogwood that trembles by the tracks or floats in the pines along the interstate, where scum of yellow pine pollen gathers at the edges of the streams. I remember my first train ride, Fresno to LA, on my own, 10 years old. I can still hear the singing as the train rocks on the winding tracks and through the tunnels of the Tehachapi Mountains. A group of Hawaiian boys in flowered shirts, touring the states, singing in the observation car. There's a hole at the bottom of the sea. One boy strums a ukulele. There's a log in the hole at the bottom of the sea. A simple song sung faster as its one verse grows longer. There's a bump on the log in the hole at the bottom of the sea. There's a frog on the bump on the log in the hole at the bottom of the sea. Until we were all laughing and singing and adding our words to fill the hole in the green sunlight of the train heading for LA. I don't know what happened then, or who met me at the station, or how I said goodbye to the Hawaiian boys and their ukulele. The memory ends with the singing. The memory ends with the singing in the train. The memory ends with the singing in the train on the way to LA. And I go on listening in Tuscaloosa, with the open shells of my ears, each one with its hole at the bottom of the sea, each one with its train and its black gloves and its trembling petals. It's a poem called Some Names, and I know there's at least one person in the audience to whom these names will mean something. One person besides me. Some names. Nooncaster, Colombini, Abrams, Perez, Patigian, Duhan, Elliot, Master Polo, Roderick. Some names come back tonight. Nooncaster was a butcher who drove a red Corvette with a fiberglass body that shattered like a toy. He always carried cash, supplied every barbecue with fresh red meat, and charmed the air with his quick delivery, bright eyes, and the odd music, part nasal, part gravel, of his voice. Colombini had biceps like baseballs. Abrams was an unlit neon sign who could turn it on when he wanted to and sing like Sam Cooke or Otis Redding long before they were ghosts, but spent most of his time in a dark dream of some childhood road listening. Perez was cool. No better word for the way he moved through the hot valley nights in spit-shine French toes or a lowered Chevy black as his eyes. His hair slicked back as if to say, the wind, sun, moon, and stars all stop when I stop. Patigian was part lion, part wren, but looked like a bear. Duhan lit the barbecue with gas splashed from a baby moon hubcap, and just as we imagined it would happen, his arm went up in flames. Elliot drove his loaded Ford on country roads and raced the trains to crossings, and almost always won. Master Polo made a mess of things in the Why Not Roadhouse because he wouldn't let it ride. He tore the antlered heads from the dumb walls. Old friends, acquaintances, role models in the badass arts of adolescence. And Roderick, we called him Red, had a fine, nervous laugh and hands quick enough to confuse even his own freckles. Roderick, one of those names on the wall in Washington you can find in your own face. Thank you. I lived in, before I moved to Montana, I've been in Montana for 7 years now, and before my wife and I moved, we lived in Miami Beach. And you couldn't pick two more different places in the world, Montana, Stevensville, Montana, and Miami Beach, Florida. Very different. Miami's a wonderful, interesting place. I think of it as what New York City must have been like in the 20s and 30s when there were these massive waves of immigration. I talked to a person down there, and he said, well, Miami is not a city, it's an urban experiment. And in many ways, it's failing as an urban experiment, but in many ways, it's successful. But you have to make a lot of adjustments to live there. One of the simple things that we take for granted, I think, is you go to the grocery store, and you fill up your shopping cart, and you get in line, you pay for your stuff, and you go home. In Miami, it was kind of an adventure. There were times that I waited in line for 45 minutes just to check out at the checkout counter, and when I got there, had additional troubles. But I enjoyed it, and I wrote a poem about it, so it was kind of all worthwhile. If you can salvage shards of your experience and put it into poetry, that's great. Okay, this is called In Line at the Supermarket. Here you've got time to think. Between the breath mints and the glamour magazines, you can feel yourself growing old. As you read the headlines of the non-newspapers, country doctor performs head transplant on alien, or something homier, passionate groom kills bride with first kiss. You're growing old, all right, but you'll never be as old as the woman who runs her shopping cart up against your hip bone and keeps on pushing until you have to say stop. She stares at you through the faintest blue haze, her face ancient, perverse, and you wonder what she sees. The couple in front of you have time to debate their selections. We don't need a ham this big, he says, as he holds it under her nose. Yes, we do, as she places her fingertips on the ham and pushes it back down lightly to the stalled conveyor. They are younger than you are, but it's hard to tell how much younger. They, too, look worn and tired. You stare at her spiked yellow hair and her bare shoulders just a breath away. On her left shoulder, a tattoo like a brand that says Mike in shaky cursive. You wonder if this man is Mike. You think about slavery. There was a man you worked with once whose style was cool, ironic, like dry ice. He referred to his night shift job as a slave. This my second slave, he said, meaning he had a day job too, meaning we have to become caricatures of ourselves in order to do these jobs, in order to live like this. You wonder what Mike does for a living. You stare at the tattoo on his arm, a skull with wings where the ears were. And under that, in case you don't get it, written in ribbony script, all capitals, the word death. For some reason, you want to laugh, but don't. Because Mike, if that's his name, has just turned to you out of boredom. And in a friendly voice you wouldn't have expected, says, man, this place is slow. But I'd rather shop here than that pantry pride down the street. My old lady went there last week for groceries, and when she came out, the car was stripped, wheels and everything. That's a bad neighborhood, man. You never know who you're going to meet. I think that, you know, one thing about America these days is that it's become an awfully violent place. I used to think I was a kind of a tough, hardened character, and that I could take it. But I started having children in middle age, and it changed my perspective on everything. And I all of a sudden got real sensitive to all this violence that's around us. I used to be part of the problem, but I'm not anymore. But I think one of the effects that all this violence has on us is very subtle. You know, we watch it on TV, we read about it in the news, we experience it daily in our lives, and we start, you know, we kind of internalize it. We don't talk about it. We don't worry about it. We don't get too cynical. But it has an effect on us, I think it takes some of our power away from us. This is a poem about a guy who's tired, he's been at work all day, he comes home, he flips on the TV and he sees another one of these things that just, you know, turns his mind. And in the poem, I guess I'm, you know, vicariously trying to take some power back away from all this stuff. It's called Evening News. He comes home from work, tired, his mind braking and accelerating, weaving through the day's traffic of acts and images, the slim hooker in yellow heels strolling the shoulder of Biscayne Boulevard, Tina Turner's voice sweating, the astronauts flaming out like meteorites over the Atlantic, a rusted shopping cart tipped over a curb, its burden lifted, its ghost fled. He puts the key in the door. The small green lizard on the wall above the mailbox cocks its head and holds still as if listening. "I'm home," he says, and opens the door, steps into the familiar room, into the quietest moment of the day. He turns on the news. He sips his beer. They're showing a poorly focused, unsteady video segment taken by a bystander of a shirtless man stabbing another man on a canal overpass in Miami Beach, just blocks away. "Jesus," he says, "what am I supposed to do?" The news anchor says it began apparently as an argument over money. The men were friends. One owed the other $10. He turns off the news. He runs the video backwards in his mind. The shirtless man rises from the railing. His friend bursts up from the bloody water, flips over the railing, lands on his feet, grabs the bare shoulders of his friend, who pulls the knife from his chest, steps back quickly, swallowing his curses, hiding the knife, moving back across the line into a life of debt and anger, friendship and choice, a life now his he must invent the next move for. He goes to the back window, stares at the uncut grass. From somewhere, a bird, a painted bunting, alights with a claim from the offices of air. Chartreuse, flame red, indigo blue. The bird says, "This is for you." My mother lives in Long Beach, and she got shaken out of bed yesterday. I spent an hour talking to her on the phone last night, and she was really frightened. And she's 77 years old, and she's got heart problems, and I thought maybe she would die of a heart attack just because she was so scared, but she's all right. And this is a poem about, so dedicated to my mother. Wrong book. I get confused here. It's called Peace. I can see my mother and my wife sitting in a booth inside the restaurant eating breakfast. As I stand in the parking lot with my 19-month-old son in my arms, we have stepped out into the morning sun because he refuses to eat or sit in a high chair or stop shouting, "Tractor, tractor," at the old man in a motorized wheelchair trying to read his paper in peace. It's peace we want amid the angers and hungers of this city. For my son, it's the peace that comes from the release from confinement and restraint. For myself, the release temporarily from the role of confiner and restrainer. And those two women we love, sitting together, unlike strangers at breakfast, we can only see their heads and shoulders through the window, are remaking quietly the necessary bonds of family, brushing off the crumbs of strangeness, and sipping coffee in a kind of peace, made possible by many choices based on what we can see and what we can't, or the other way around. At the corner of Long Beach Boulevard and Ocean Avenue, you can see neither ocean nor beach, but the bow of the Queen Mary hulks in the distance between high rises, from which older men and women have been evicted so the buildings may be renovated to further the economic goals of the Republic. My mother, still one of the lucky, has found a low-rent room on the fourth floor of Baptist Gardens with a view of a parking lot where her 67 Pontiac Catalina is parked and still runs when she needs it. There's a tree she loves to look down on, a Mexican market that is usually open, an intersection with a constant surf of traffic, and morning and evening, the warm, soft air that smells of exhaust in the Pacific. I'll read another poem. I'll read that little poem, Church, which also comes out of taking my kids down to visit their grandmother. It's a dangerous place to have a grandmother live. There's a lot of muggings and stuff that happen on the streets down there. And this is, I'm standing outside with my little boy, and this, I'm paranoid, and I'm holding my young son in my arms, and this guy comes up. And, it's called Church. Tarnished fake gold chains and cross, dirty gold tangles of hair around a bruised, sun-scabbed face in which the eyes sputter but burn like an arc welder underwater. One, I could cut your throat, hand in a pocket. The other whispering, help me, please, through the dead Los Angeles air. He comes toward me, father, holding my son in my arms. Son, for whose sake I feel a sudden ferocity pulse through my heart. As he steps quickly toward us, through still air soon to rise from the oil-stained asphalt of this parking lot, warming in morning sun, this church where I offer the coins and receive his blessing, and we hold each other a moment only among the uncommitted murders in our eyes. This is a poem that I associate with Montana, and I don't know if it would have the same meaning as it does up there, but there are more cows in Montana than people, and cows kind of run the country up there, you know. They have certain rights, and I guess I'm sort of being hard on the cows here, although I love cows. I really do. Build a world of cows and see where it gets you. My cows, really my neighbor's cows, move through the day like worlds unto themselves. Between the fences they revolve, between night and day they stand. They stand for the ground they stand on. They stand for the grass, green or burned, alive or the sturdy husks of lives. They stand for the air, the sky, the weather that shows no mercy. Over the fields, down the hill to the gully, up the hill to the hill, they drift like clouds. They lie down in the sun, suggesting at a distance the first rocks that came to rest. These cows stand for the world we build. And though we see daily the terror of where we're going, we say, more, more, like the cows who are, like us, between the seeds and the flames, a truce. I'll read you another couple more Montana poems. This one is called Turning Things Over. Kind of a certain. I'm a meditative poet, but my meditation. I can't sit still and meditate very well, so I like to walk, and I do a lot of walking and hiking and stuff. And I think that's a form of meditation that I really like. And this is kind of about that. It doesn't make sense otherwise. Turning things over, Rock Creek, Montana. Rock Creek is this really beautiful trout stream. It's one of the most beautiful trout streams in the country. And I get over there as often as I can and camp out and walk around, fish, that sort of thing. One of many witnesses, he watches the passage of the moon from ridge to ridge above the canyon. He thinks, light on the water, wind in the trees, river in the leaves, leaves in the river, rainbow in the river, fish in the rainbow, fire in the fish, soul in the fire, this air weighs more, he thinks, in the bottom of the canyon on the ridge of night. Water in the creek coaxes stones toward the river. Water in his thoughts goes around and around. Before dawn, the wind stops. A single bird tries a note, and soon the trees are full of persuasion. He walks a dirt road as the light comes. Night holds on in pockets in the pines. He breathes, and something takes his breath and turns his gaze. Light comes out of the pines, riding the big flanks of moose. Three moose in procession. Profound thoughts he wants to hold but can't. His breath drifts with the air, adrift with moose. Gone into the trees, into the pockets of night and the pines. He's left with the light of one small idea. Good morning. He walks it down the road. Good morning, good morning. And morning bugles like a bull elk, and trees begin to breathe and branch with thought that stops above his head and points like antlers up. Crack of rock on rock comes down the canyon. That light blush on the heart fades, then fires. Up the slope and over the scree, the bird of his gaze goes and lights on a bear digging at the base of a boulder. The bear rocks the boulder from side to side, gives it a shove from the top, offers it up to gravity as the sun rises and shines in the eyes of the bear. Who looks down on what? A feast of larvae, ants, worms, exposed in the damp earth, or an empty hole that attests to hunger. Along the creek, mist and shadow linger. When he looks again, the bear is gone. He goes on walking, turning things over in the early light. Now I'll read you another moose poem. I've become infatuated with moose since I moved to Montana. We got a lot of moose up there. And I used to think they were sort of the homeliest creatures on earth. And now I think they're beautiful. I just love them. I think one of the most beautiful poems in the English language is Elizabeth Bishop's poem, The Moose. It's a beautiful, long, lyrical narrative poem about a bus ride that she takes. And she's driving along in this bus at night, and all of a sudden a moose comes out of the woods and the bus stops. And everybody in the bus kind of gets out and looks at the moose. And it becomes this moment in the poem, a sort of moment of transcendence where everybody shares this image, mystical image of the moose. And just a beautiful, beautiful poem. So for years I've been wanting to, you know, I had that in the back of my mind. Now that I see a lot of moose, I've started writing about them. This is called Remember the Moose. She must have come down from high mountain meadows where bear grass blooms had dried and fallen. Paintbrush put away its colors, and mud wallows begun to freeze and stay frozen past noon. Down along the creek, through aspen, alder, and willow thickets, to high grass along a road leading to town. Why she kept on coming, you can only guess. Rich green smell of cemetery grass, muted bellow of a distant bull, old path imprinted in her genes, deep doubts, simple curiosity. Maybe she was lost, or came as a reminder of something lost. A moose grazing among the graves on Sunset Hill is an image one might hold for years, turning it over and over, working it into a story, or finding it strangely lit, inverted in a dream. Remember the moose outside the tent in Idaho? The sunlight, or the moonlight, and mosquitoes, how she looked like a boulder in the creek until she lifted her great head from the water, big worldly angel, and turned to look at you with ropes of weeds hanging from her mouth. By day, she strolled among the parks, swing sets, and jungle gyms, stopping to sniff the dull shine of a slide, or stopping high as a house in some child's eye. Parents, sensing danger, tried to shoo her away, but she followed her own calling. Nearly blind after the sun went down, street lights and house lights surrounded her, a confusion of moons. She must have picked one to lead her on. They found her on the Newsom's front porch, snout pressed against the wall, back legs splayed. Terrified, someone said, as neighbors gathered to watch the wildlife officials load their darts and end her urban visit in a sudden blur of drugs. Think of Golden Gate Park half a life ago, a day of dancing and chanting. Thousands of hairy kids, men, women, dogs with beads and dirty bandanas, a fog of breath and marijuana pulsing around black banks of speakers, blasting the twilight with drumbeat and guitar shrieks. Someone smiling hands you a hit of something. You walk off across a baseball diamond towards some tree or siren or patch of grass, looking for your country. A shock-eyed man marches barefoot, mouthing a manic recitation like a fuse burning. You walk and walk into dark and lie down and stare at the moon until it comes down and covers your face with its bowl of white light. After the drugs took hold, the drugs wore off. They loaded her on a truck, gently as they could, drove her out of town on dirt roads, lifted her down into high grass, waited to see her waken. Think of leaving and coming back. Think what you have nurtured and betrayed. Think of the towns and cities you changed with your absence. Think of the country. Remember the moose turning away, lowering her head into the water, leaving you the after image. Unspoken words, weeds hanging from your mouth. Remember waking in a colder place, glad to breathe and see your breath. I guess I've got time for a couple more. About three more. You want to hear three more? Three more. All right. Promise, no more. Just three. All right. Two poems about the birth of my first child. One of them is a odd poem called "Among the Various Errors." I've gone down into the river to see what it's like to be a fish. Shadows of wings have passed over me, and I've hidden in fear. I've seen nymphs swim up from the rocks toward the light, seen the delicate ones move in the meniscus, and I've risen to take them in my mouth. I've felt the terror of the hook and the pull of the tight line. I've broken free and lay stunned on the bottom, pumping my red gills to live. I've quivered in the hand and beheld the eyes of the man I am. All this among the various errors and insights of the imagination. I still know almost nothing about grief, except that it has value and can't be thrown away. And laughter is a kind of water that riffles over the rocks and shines. My friend told the story of a lonely man who found a dead baby in the can and took it home and washed it carefully, wrapped it in a clean towel, held it gently, and wept all day until the police came and took it away. When my son was born, he spent a long time in the birth canal. His mother would push, and the top of his head would appear, crowning, then disappear. It seemed like hours before he was all the way born into the one good hand of the doctor on duty, who held my son's head down a moment, wiped clear the nostrils so the first breath swelled his small chest. His eyes opened, and he looked around the room in true wonder. And in that slippery moment, he slid off between her legs and fell through the close air down into the bottom of a plastic trash bag placed there over a hamper to catch the placenta. The doctor fished him quickly out by one tiny arm. After that, the doctor wouldn't look at me. I might have said something in anger, but joy still held my tongue. I cut the cord, shook the doctor's good hand. I tell the story now and laugh, how my firstborn son slipped from his mother into the trash. In the birthing room, you can say anything, but there are things that can't be told. They've worked out a method of breathing to help you through, to ease the pain. But the pain is deeper than breath goes. I'll never know. Here, for me, things are as simplified as a traffic light. The quickly passing yellow of choice between two commands. Here's my hand. Nothing can drive me away. I am like a stud in the wall that makes this room possible. You are like a sunflower facing the sun. For better or worse, here for the duration. Let the knees buckle, the hernia bulge, the sweat swim along the lines of the skin. Let the discs of the spine fuse with cold fire. Let the feet flatten and the small vessels in the eyes burst and redden. Listen to the voice of the will, egged on by the heart, setting out on this journey through the mountains, deserts, and swamps of the body. I'll hold your hand and fan for as many hours as it takes. This is December 10th and January 28th. This is the day within the days we've been moving toward. Nurse says, don't push. Resist the urge to push. Doctor says, push. I say, breathe, breathe. You open your mouth, release another mottled sparrow of pain. You can say anything. And the last poem I'll read is another Arizona poem. It's set in, many of you have probably been up to Wupatki National Monument, north of Flagstaff, and there are these lovely Anasazi and Sinawa ruins up there.
There's one called the Citadel. How many of you have ever seen the Citadel? It's that kind of round one. Yeah, it's kind of falling apart. It's misnamed, I think. Archaeologists of a certain era considered everything in the Southwest a sort of fortification against war and disaster, but I'm convinced that the Citadel was some kind of an observatory or a high place to look out over the land. I don't know. But this takes place at the Citadel. By the time I had walked out of the canyon toward the end of a day of deep quiet and daydreams among lizards and wrens, a day of clarity in the sun and puzzles in the shadows, where I found the petroglyph of a running animal pecked into the rock at the base of the canyon 1,000 years ago. The animal, I thought at first, was a horse, but after looking a while and thinking about it, realized was a mountain lion. I was ready, I thought, for anything. I was feeling strong, light, open. I was ready to sing for a stranger or walk into the cinder hills with one of the spirits of Lomaki, or put on a black satin cape, step out of my dusty shoes, croak and flap off to ride thermals with the ravens. I was that happy, as if a new depth had entered my life. When I came upon the tattooed family posing for pictures among the walls and rubble of Box Canyon Pueblo, and noticed their station wagon with Indiana plates and the trailer with the words skin tattoos painted carefully in big black letters, I considered asking the smiling father, his tattooed belly bulging proudly beneath his shirt, to make a portrait of the lion on my chest. I was that happy. But asked instead, "How you doing?" "Pretty good so far," he smiled, and I went on walking across the road, past a battered pickup, to Nalakihu and the Citadel, home to the Hisatsinom, ancestors of the Hopi, guardian spirits of the land nicknamed America. I suppose I should keep this to myself, but there are things in a life that happen only once and make us who we are, like being born from one woman, or the first true kiss that makes all the others possible. I suppose I should hold my heart hostage to a regular beat, and if it must go faster, they say, it should do so gradually, so it isn't strained or damaged, so the whole system starts to break down, and the invisible bird that flies back and forth between the extremities bursts into a sudden scattering of individual feathers. But there they were, three of them, standing at the top of the Citadel in late afternoon light. Silhouettes among the rocks, rising like gods and human figures from the ancient walls. I stood quietly on the trail below until one of them came down to me and put a hand on my shoulder, lowered his head, opened my shirt, and spoke in the old way directly to my heart. "Don't go any further, heart," he said, "until you are blessed." He rubbed huma over my chest and touched my forehead with the white dust of cornmeal on his fingers. He poured huma in my left hand and placed a sprig of cedar in my right. "Go pray," he said. "What for?" I asked. "Pray for now, this place, all your relations. Pray for the hostages." Then he walked off down the trail to join the others. Not gods, but poor living men from Moonkopi, here at the home of their ancestors, to pray for the world and bless a stranger. Thank you.